Hello and welcome to the first The End User podcast. I am here with Charlie Metal.
It's actually Metal Charlie, but I'm here with Chris Barnes.
My name is Chris Barnes and welcome to the first show here. I just want to explain a little bit about the show. Charlie, I'll hand it to you in a second and what you think the show should be about. But I want to bring a serious end-user perspective to the world of technology news. You know, we buy all of these things, and we are as poor as the next college student out there, so I want to bring that perspective to the front of the line. So, Charlie, what platform are you representing for us?
Representing might be strong. However, I do have in front of me two distinct versions of Apple OS X.
Okay, is that Snow Leopard?
I've Snow Leopard and Leopard. I'm running on a Apple MacBook Pro, which is running Snow Leopard, and a G5 from back in the day, which is running Leopard.
Excellent. I used to have a friend that had a G5 like that. I am running Windows 7 and part-time in Linux for my development class that I'm taking at American University. What phone are you carrying, Charlie?
I carry, you know, an Apple iPhone. What can I say? I'm a loyalist.
He's Apple through and through, and I am a Windows Mobile man. I suppose I'm Microsoft through and through, I guess you could say.
Well, you know, I think that's interesting. You know, what you're not telling everyone is your extensive experience in the Windows platform, the beta testing, all the good stuff.
Oh, yeah. I flash ROMs to my phone all the time and get the latest of the latest of the latest. You know, I was a beta tester for Windows 7, as were millions of other people. It's the biggest beta program ever that that I've heard of. So I'm pretty familiar, you might say.
I do say.
Okay, well, anyways, that's what this podcast is going to be about. So let's head on to the stories. The first story we have here is that the Apple iPad was released. When was that?
Well, it hasn't actually been released. And you know what's even more interesting is that they announced it, but you can't order ahead of time. And the reason is it's not gotten FCC approval yet.
Oh, is that right? It hasn't gone through the FCC yet.
Well, by all accounts, the first iPhone didn't get FCC approval until a month before it was released, even though it had been announced quite ahead of time. So it's nothing to worry about. But yeah, no, it's not gotten FCC approval yet.
So as an Apple man, are you getting one?
I want to defer back to the statement you made. We're all, you know, essentially poor college students, and you know, as much as I'd love another device, a device between $500 and $1,000 is, especially one that's not essential, is probably not going to be part of my my gadget repertoire in the near future.
Yeah, it's pushing it for what it is. You know, I feel like if they had positioned it as an e-reader of some sort, which they did a little bit, but...
Well, you know, I think they did. I actually think they did. I mean, in the Engadget video, which we're discussing essentially, did you see how the guy manipulated the pages? It looked just like he was bending a real page on a real book.
Oh, the iBook application looks absolutely phenomenal. That's the one thing that looks really, really exciting. I'm not sure how much I'd want to read on that on an LCD screen like that. I think I would prefer... Again, I don't have an e-ink device, but I would think if I were to buy anything right now, it would be some kind of e-ink device.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for that, especially given, you know, anybody with a sleep disorder out there or who appreciates the glare of an LCD screen, that can be hard in your eyes. And part of the appeal of an e-ink reader is simply that, you know, it's just like a regular book. It produces no light. You actually require a lamp to read off of it, which means that there is no glare, and it's very easy on your eyes.
Now, this is a little bit off topic, but have you seen the rumors of an Asus e-ink reader coming down the pipe sometime later this year? Probably the last three-fourths of the year or so.
I've seen rumors of everything Asus. They're clearly poising themselves to make everything that everyone else has made but Asus.
Yeah, they have kind of a top-down approach. All right, well, I think we covered it. What do you think?
I think there's a lot more to be said for it. I'm surprised that neither of us panned the device and, you know, absolutely wiped our fingers with it. But I will say there are aspects of it that I do like. I always love the next gadget. I'm an early adopter, and you know, it's gotten me in some trouble before, but I don't think it's meant for our generation. I don't think it is. I think it's meant for the classroom generation to, you know, to supplant the giant textbooks every biology student has and do all of those things. It's not going to replace my laptop, and I'm certainly not going to replace my laptop with it. But I can see it creating a niche that currently doesn't exist. And I think that's the only way that Apple's going to really sell this thing. They don't want it to be another MacBook Air.
Yeah, the MacBook Air didn't do so hot. Although the MacBook Air, by all accounts, was a very sexy-looking device.
Yeah, well, they do sexy-looking well. I think they failed pretty hardcore on the functionality aspect of the MacBook Air.
Absolutely. Okay, well, I think that's it for that one. The next story is the Google Nexus One phone, built by HTC, I might add, has finally enabled multi-touch in the Android operating system. I don't have an Android device. You don't have an Android device, but we can still comment about this.
And I'm familiar with multi-touch, so, as are you, I'm sure.
Actually, not on any of my devices. I don't have multi-touch anywhere, because Windows Mobile is a resistive screen, so we can't have multi-touch functionality built in. But I have used it here and there. But I think it's a pretty big thing because of the purported rumors that Google had been asked nicely by Apple to not include multi-touch while Eric Schmidt was on the board of Apple. I guess I'm putting on my tinfoil hat here. But he leaves a few months later. The Google Android operating system gets native multi-touch. That's a tough coincidence to throw away, at least.
Well, coincidence actually might be soft. I will point out that judging by Apple's legal tendencies, they don't really ask anything nicely. I'm a huge fan of Apple, but it's clear that, you know, they tend to prosecute and sue and do all those things. Going back to Eric Schmidt being on the board of Apple, you know, that was the case in a much more naive day. By all accounts, Android was created by Google in an effort to really shake up the Windows Mobile marketplace. You know, basically, if you've looked what they've...
It's definitely its closest competitor, for sure. There's no doubt about that.
Well, I mean, Windows Mobile and Android. If you look at all the apps they're creating, for instance, Google Docs is a great competitor to Excel and Word and all those things. They're clearly trying to show users that you can migrate away from these core products that are all Microsoft. And in the same way that back in the 80s, Apple basically said, you know, they screamed, IBM is evil and we're going to take them down. You remember the commercial from the 84 Super Bowl. That's sort of what Google decided to do. What ended up happening is that the Windows Mobile marketplace is so small, and none of our generation, I mean, you're a strong exception here. Our generation doesn't use it by and large. And so what they were doing, they're aiming to do, was to break up the Windows monopoly across all sectors. And they thought Android's a great way to do it. It's a great example of do no evil, let's be free. But what ended up happening is that there was no market for it for that specific segment. The people who were using Windows Mobile were using Windows Mobile anyway. Android ended up having to sell against the iPhone. And that's sort of where the enmity between the two companies sort of started creeping up. If you heard Jobs after the announcement of the iPad, he did a Q&A with Apple staff. And the Apple guy, you know, asked him something about the relationship with Google. And even though there were other questions to answer, Jobs sort of went out of his way to say, you know, Google's do no evil policy is bullshit, excuse the language, and it's very clear that there are strong tensions. So anyway, they ended up competing with Android with the Apple iPhone, and in so doing, they condemned themselves to, you know, having to have something of an app store and having to have touch technology and all that stuff. And it's clear that Android was being developed during the period of time that Eric Schmidt was on the board, and I could see them coming to some agreement along those lines, hypothetically, maybe, when the effort was to dominate Microsoft. But now the problem is they're competing directly with Apple. you know, the prime user space for the Android devices these days, especially the Motorola, the new Motorola device operating on
Droid.
Yeah, the Droid operating the Snapdragon processor. You know, it's really.
Oh no, that's one of the Cortex.
You're
the
sure
ARM
it's not?
Cortex.
Okay.
No, it's not. The Google Nexus One is the first Snapdragon Android device.
Okay. Well.
But it's a snappy processor nonetheless, so not to take anything away from it.
No, absolutely right. You know, I think the message here is that what ended up happening is basically people who didn't want to be on the AT&T system said, well, we kind of want an iPhone anyway. And the Android operating system sort of turned into that. So there are some issues, I think, that Google will face with the Android operating system, not the least of which is that, you know, historically, the reason OS X has worked so well, you know, is that, and the iPhone, Apple has extraordinary control of all of their hardware specs. They are really a hardware company with a software problem, to put it loosely. And because they have control of all this hardware, and there's a finite amount of it, they don't really have to write drivers and things that'll make a system unstable. For multiple devices. What's happening with Android, however, is that this year alone, something in the order of 52 devices across multiple makers and across multiple carriers will be manufactured and used, and all of them will have Android and be running fundamentally different system specs, and you'll see problems integrating different applications across these phones, and I think it's going to be a nightmare for Google.
Yeah, that has been the classic Linux problem. You know, I put Linux onto my computer, and I love Linux. You know, I use Linux all the time. But there's always a driver missing. There's always one driver missing.
Well, I think it's more analogous to the Windows problem, you know, when XP and 2000 and all that had to operate on jillions of platforms.
Yes, and... largely, you know, in moving from Vista to Vista from XP, and now to 7, all the drivers issues that I've had, at least, they are all gone now. So I think they've done a really good job of kind of integrating it. We've got one story that contradicts that statement that we'll talk about a little bit later, but let's move on with some more Microsoft news that I've put in the show notes here. Microsoft reports a profit of $6.66 billion in Q1.
Quarter one.
What do you think?
Wow. And that's net profits. Gross profits are something like $14.4 billion.
Yeah, and they had $19.02 billion in revenue. And this is pretty much all due to Windows 7. You know, there's not much to say about this. They're a massive company. They post massive profits. And they have even more massive revenue. I don't know offhand, but I think Apple's profits are actually higher than that, aren't they?
I have no idea, but that's not due to software. That's due to hardware. These, you know, Apple makes things out of metal, and then they just put software on it. So I would be very surprised by that. In fact, if Apple had higher actual revenue, but I mean, nonetheless, 6.66 net. $6 billion in quarter one. That's an extraordinary revenue.
I must be thinking year over year, not in quarters for Apple.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, you know, look, do the multiplication. We're going on $28-30 billion right there.
Yeah, I think that's the case. So anyways, that pretty much speaks for itself. Microsoft is indeed the devil. So
I gotta tell you, I'm an Apple fan, and I would never say Microsoft. I take that back. I would definitely say Microsoft is.
Well, no,
but Windows
this is incontrovertible proof that Microsoft.
Oh,
is indeed.
I see the 6.66.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So no, but Windows 7 is a really good product, and its criticism is that it's what Vista should have been, and that's absolutely true.
You know, but what do you do but learn from your mistakes?
Yeah, exactly right. What do you ask of them? So speaking of learning from mistakes. This month, at the latter half of this month, Windows Mobile 7 will be announced, not released, but announced by Microsoft at the Mobile World Congress. As a Windows Mobile user, this is Microsoft's chance to kind of take back that consumer space. You know, they're very strong in business just because Windows Mobile is very good at syncing with ActiveSync and Microsoft Exchange, as it ought to be. But they've really lost the consumer side of the phone. You know, only stupid nerds like myself would actually use a Windows Mobile 6.5 device. In fact, they're kind of the laughingstock of kind of the geek culture world. So this is the first time they've announced that they're going to integrate what they've done with the Zune HD into Windows Mobile 7. And this is going to be a completely fresh take on Windows Mobile. They're more or less scrapping what is present in 6.x and moving forward with something.
Which is absolutely also essential. And going back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, the Zune HD interface is actually fantastic.
Yes. That the Zune HD was a critically acclaimed device, but it didn't sell that many. I don't know off the top of my head how many it sold, but it wasn't the best in terms of sales. So, you know, it certainly was no contender for your iPods.
Right, but I'm thinking of the way that, you know, the computer syncs with the phone or all of these things. Taking a lesson from the Zune HD with Windows Mobile is a great move because it was intuitive and pretty. You know, it did some things that Apple is known to do.
I think this is Microsoft's finally getting all of their components to a modern level. The Xbox 360 took it there, and it is there now. The Zune HD is there, whether or not people bought it, you know. It's there. And Windows Mobile is kind of off the side of the road, you know.
Well, I'd like to take a minute to look at the specs that they're talking about for Windows Mobile 7, because they're terrifying.
They are absolutely terrifying.
I don't know how big those batteries are going to be, but they must be enormous.
Yes, they must be. So the minimum chassis requirement is a 1 gigahertz, presumably Snapdragon or Tegra processor. The minimum resolution is 800 by 480.
Which is double that of most every other phone. I mean, that's an extraordinarily large screen.
The Droid is 800 by 480, I believe, actually.
Really?
The Nexus 1 is also 800 by 480, I think.
Oh, man, me and my iPhone, we're feeling emasculinated. Thank God we have the biggest and best iPhone app store.
That is yet to be debated. Actually, speaking of the App Store, the Windows Mobile doesn't have an App Store. Well, they do. It's just poorly implemented. I think Apple should be able to get third-party programs onto the iPhone via some other source. What do you think about that?
You know, I'm going to go ahead and actually disagree with the masses. You know, I work with so many people, and I know so many friends, computer science majors, all that, who are chronically jailbreaking their phones and doing all sorts of stuff. I think the fact that Apple is so stringent in their process, incredibly stupid and subjective though it may be to get an app out there, really does mean that the phone is fundamentally more secure. And I got to tell you, in an age where quickly phones are computers and computers are, you know, becoming phones in one way or another, you know, you have your netbooks that are all operating on wireless spectrum, it is very important to realize that these devices could easily be taken over or broken or turned into zombie machines. And I think Apple's done a great job making sure that won't happen, even though it means that a lot of really great apps, Google Voice comes to mind,
On the Windows Mobile platform, I have at least 3 or 4 apps. You know, I only use one, though.
Oh, man. Are you kidding me? On my phone, let's see. I was bored the other night. I couldn't sleep. And I was looking at the time. It was 4:49. And I was thinking to myself, is that a Prime number? So I went into, you know, the App Store and I looked for, you know, is it Prime? And in fact, there is a program called Is It Prime? And more affirmingly, 449 is a Prime number.
Well, that is just ridiculous. I can't imagine doing that, instead of hopping up to the computer and just Googling it, because Google would do that for you.
So I agree. I think we should move to what both of us experienced last Wednesday night. Was it Wednesday night?
What was that?
It was the State of the Union. Was it Wednesday?
Oh, sure. Yeah, let's we'll come back to the other Microsoft story shortly. Actually, you know what? Let's just go over that real quick. So Windows 7 is experiencing a problem by reporting that the batteries on laptops need to be replaced. I actually saw this on my EPC. It said that the battery needs to be replaced, and it's fine. So reporters went to Microsoft.
Were you disturbed when this first happened, or did you Google it?
Oh, no. I was like, no, it lasts 3 hours. I'm good. But apparently reporters went to ask Microsoft about this, and they said, it's the BIOS.
And frankly, I got to say, the history of Microsoft errors, blue screens of death, and, you know, all the good stuff, the fact that it is falsely reporting something is wrong is okay by me. It's so much less bad than all the things it could have been.
Yeah, that's for certain. Okay, anyways, let's move on to more important things. I don't really care if my battery meter says I need a new battery when I know I don't. So
my battery says I need a new battery, and it's actually completely true. I disconnect thing, and it's going dead.
And it's going dead immediately? How many minutes do you have on it?
I have no idea. Let's see. All it says, actually, is battery is charged, service battery. Although, if I look at an analytic tool, the health of my battery is at 31%. It's been cycled 259 times.
Jeez.
So not many minutes is the answer. But the State of the Union, the President of the United States of America.
Yeah, we'll move on here. So, the President Obama is very tech forward, as you could see from his campaign to become president. You know, he was all over, you know, these town hall meetings on YouTube or whatever it was he was doing. But
that relative to his competitor, a man who didn't know what the internet was and was talking about how he was being taught to use it. Tech forward can be relative. In this case, Obama is very tech savvy.
I heard there was something called the internet.
True story.
So, anyways, at whitehouse.gov/live, they were streaming the State of the Union address live, and they drew 1.3 million viewers, not on the TV, but on the internet, on the computer.
That's excluding the tens and tens and tens of thousands. I think they said it was like 70,000 people who used the whitehouse.gov app, the White House app, on the iPhone, which I did.
Yeah, because this was a study done by the Nielsen company, you know, the company that does the TV ratings and whatnot. That's just staggering that many people say, okay, I'm not going to sit down and watch it on my TV, but I will watch it somehow, some way, on the internet.
On my phone.
On my phone.
what I really liked was the fact that you and I watched State of the Union together.
On the TV, I might add.
Right, on a TV, and not to belittle in any way, shape, or form, but we'll say it wasn't an HD TV. It was a vacuum tube TV. And the color was just a little off. People were a little too red. I mean, John Boehner, that guy, always orange. This time, red. You know, I mean, like, the hues were off. But you took...
It's like a very, very angry Smurf.
Well, he is very angry, and I wish he was a Smurf. But that's neither here nor there. We're getting out of context. No, you took out your device. You actually went to whitehouse.gov, and you started playing the thing. I looked down at your phone, and everything is in beautiful color, and it's the right hue, and all these things. And I made the mistake of remarking upon how off the TV was, and I had to cover my tracks by saying, no, you can turn a few knobs, and the hues will change. But
that's just a VGA screen as well. You know, it was lower res but higher pixel density since it's so small.
Right, but I mean, everybody looks so much better, and I think another thing, another important aspect of this sort of revolution is that we've chronically been a society that for certain ceremonial things have been transfixed. You know, we watch it with a large group of people, but as you know, we saw by both of our phones, maybe this is getting a little unstuck. Maybe people are going to end up walking around the street listening to President Obama. Maybe they're not going to get to see Joe Biden make a fool of himself or Nancy Pelosi, you know, smirk at people. But
I still contend that she is indeed a robot sent from the future.
A robot sent from the future who is, let's be totally honest, kind of dead sexy for a 70-year-old.
Okay, we'll stop there on that story. So, all right, Charlie, the next one's yours.
All right. So, as we all know, the recording industry's efforts to continue, you know, persecuting, or maybe prosecuting is the right word, but I like persecuting.
Harassing
moms and dads and children for illegal downloads. You know, it continues. It continues in silence, but it does happen. A while ago, a woman in Minnesota federal court.
It's Jamie Thomas Rassett.
Yeah, exactly right. She apparently was prosecuted for downloading 24 songs, and they awarded the RIAA, the Recording Industry Association of America, $1.9 million.
Yeah.
Now I did the math on that, and that is something like $80,000 a song. Wow. You know, I mean, I wish I made that much. Much in a year. God, that'd be great. But you know, this is a mother of two with who recently she, you know, when she came back to the judge, she, instead of saying all the things that she did before, which was really quite little, she said, "Oh no, it was my kids and my ex-boyfriend," you know. But this is a woman who had kids and an ex-boyfriend, and clearly not making that much. And $1.92 million is a hell of a lot of money. And even though the judge was not sympathetic to her, and in fact was very critical of the fact that she sort of changed winds and blamed it on other people, when he basically thought, you know, she did the crime, and it was disingenuous and dishonest and sort of mean-spirited of her to blame someone else for it, he reduced the fine to $54,000. Now, that's still something like $2,500. It's $2,250.
Yeah, it's still more than many people's salaries per year.
Yeah, absolutely. I know people who live out and you know, do fine on that kind of money. But still a lot less than it could have been, and certainly reflects the sympathies of court that realizes, you know, the judge actually had to do a couple of things. One is he had to recognize that the actual incident and the value of each of these songs was something significantly lower than $80,000 a song.
That's for certain.
And the second thing is he actually had to use the power of remititure. And, you know, gotta love Ars Technica. They never hedge on the words and the vocabulary. Had to look that one up. The judge used his power because the jury awarded the recording industry the $1.92 million. And the judge used his power, his discretion, the power of remititure, to reduce that fine. So it was in stark contrast to what one might call the mob effect, or the ability of, you know, myriad lawyers to impress upon people that this person is evil and must be sentenced to $1.92 million of debt. It certainly exhibited a certain sense that we don't often see, but is progressively, you know, it's more often seen in these verdicts. Now, it's important to notice that what she did was quite in the open. She was using a program that was very easy to track, and what she was doing was illegal. And anybody out there doing similar should think twice. But at least we have this notion that there is some justice for the unjust. I want to move on a little bit. Do you have anything to add to that?
No, let's go on with that. You have the next story.
I do. So you sent me an article, which is very interesting, about the Hobbesian state of nature. And if anybody remembers, Hobbes was a famous philosopher, very much at ends with John Locke. who said, you know, life is, it's, what is it? It's short, nasty, and brutish. Something along those lines.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, in this case, the contention is that the internet is short, nasty, and brutish. Okay, yes. So the title, which once again we found at Ars Technica, which is a great site, is No Rules, Internet Security, a Hobbesian State of Nature. And basically what they did was they looked at where cyber attacks were across the globe and in the industry, and they said, you know, some of the hack attacks that were happening, as judged by the security vendor McAfee. 54% of surveyed executives, and in this case we're talking about real company executives, who are essentially being blackmailed with content stolen from servers of their own company. 54% of executives experienced large-scale denial-of-service attacks by a high-level adversary, like organized crime, terrorists, or a nation state. Now, we need only remember Google bought a month ago announcing that they may suspend operations in China because emails in both China and of the Dalai Lama and of people in the U.S., essentially advocates for freedom and change in China, their mailboxes were being hacked. And then a bunch
of... Yeah, they were hacked. They said, to hell with you. We may pull out.
Which was...
We'll see what they end up doing, but...
Let's be fair. Do no evil is a wonderful slogan, but when it comes to 1.3 billion ethnic Chinese, there's no way Google's pulling out of that place.
That is a very large market.
It's an extraordinarily large market. And don't get me wrong. I hope to be the privacy aspect of this this conversation, this long-running conversation. But they're never going to pull out of there. But they did do something very brave, which was to say, you know, we're a company, and the fact is we have been attacked. The people who use our services have been attacked. And what ended up happening was, like, dozens of other companies in the U.S. and other places said, we faced similar attacks. People have broken into our computers and done all these things. So it's not rare. Places like China, and of course we're saying China, you know, none of these attacks could be traced back specifically to a government entity, but everybody, the consensus is that the government was behind this.
Well, they more or less used proxies, right?
They was all traced back to a server in Taiwan.
Right, okay.
But yeah, no, exactly, these proxies. But I mean, there is great hesitancy. Nobody really knows the battleground of the internet, like when you can declare for sure that somebody did this. You know, the bottom line is China has realized something very smart, which is you can't launch your attacks from an official government building. But if that building's down the street and it's owned by a company that's owned by the government, but nobody knows about it, totally cool. And nobody can
say. That's...
Anyway.
It almost feels like the Tor network, you know, peel away the layers of the onion, and finally you reach a conclusion that may be the Chinese government, right?
Was that in the article, or was that a movie? I feel like I heard that before. Maybe Anyway, so basically this argument said was 54% of these executives had faced large-scale DNS attacks. This is essentially worldwide. 57% said they had suffered DNS poisoning in half the cases, multiple times per month, which of course essentially disrupts the entire network for that organization. 70% had dealt with network vandalism. So that's people breaking in, stealing information. That's people inside the company taking USB keys with information out and handing it off to other people. Loss of sensitive data. And 20% said they've been victims of internet extortion schemes. I mean, we are really in a very scary place when it comes to the internet. People all over the world, whether it's, you know, Asia, the United States, you know, North America, anywhere, are extorting and blackmailing executives and companies as wholes with information that they would have otherwise never divested or let see in the light of day. Insider secrets.
Yeah. Also, what's really, really surprising to me is not necessarily these numbers, the 50 some odd percent. You know, that makes a lot of sense to me. But in half the cases of the people suffering DNS poisoning, it was multiple times per month. I mean, that is staggering.
Yes, it's clearly an organization or a person, expressing their wrath upon an organization. Sometimes this stuff goes much deeper. And who knows what large company with servers across the world, like Google faces on a daily basis by large organizations, botnets, and the like. I actually think there was something, you know, a lot of this can sort of be intuited. I mean, I've seen the nasty side of the internet. But there was one thing that really quite shocked me. This paragraph says that, but such events are rare in the U.S. Only 12% of U.S. executives said that extortion had been a problem. Move to India, however, and the number skyrockets to 40%.
40%, my God.
When they did a poll of, in fact, international organizations and executives, basically what all of these firms said was they admired the internet security in the United States. I mean, that's surprising to me. You know, I know of intrusions at the Pentagon. I know of intrusions in the House and Senate that took down computers and you know, harassed individual congresspeople.
Hell, I run Windows, so they take me down, too.
I run Mac OS X, so we're completely ignored.
Yeah,
but
you are.
You know, as somebody who's worked in Congress and a couple other things, this is some scary stuff. We have seen some terrifying events. But if we are admired for our internet security, you have to wonder what goes on in the rest of the world. This is a terrifying trend. Anyway, yeah. I want to leave it there because we've got a lot more to talk about.
Yeah, all right. Let's move on then.
So there was a recent census done by a student, he's a senior at, was it Princeton University? It was Princeton University. He did what he called a census of internet file sharing under the BitTorrent protocol. And he said that 99% of files were copyright infringing, which is to say that on BitTorrent protocol, 99% of all the files seen by his census were literally copyright infringing.
The keyword being census.
Right. Well, I think the problem is the word census. A census literally means, a census is like, you know, that commercial you see on TV every day, or the person who comes to your door, or the mail you're about to receive that says, please fill this out, tell us what, you know, race, how many kids you've got, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, about yourself. That's a census. A census is about taking information from the entire community and then getting a lay of the land. What he did was a study. He took a sample. And his sample was, I think it was 1,021 files.
It was almost one byte.
Yeah,
1,024 being a byte.
I was thinking more along the lines of it was a nibble of the real world of torrenting.
Right.
So let's give some little numbers about this. He said that 46% of all torrenting traffic was based on movies and TV shows, which is a pretty staggering amount, given that he said only 10% was used for music and 14% pornography. Now, keep in mind that BitTorrent and things like Nutella and Kazaa and all these kinds of programs for file sharing are very much the fallout from the recording industry's incredibly narrow-minded decision to destroy the original inception of Napster. I don't mean that thing you pay and then you get to like hold on to your music, sort of.
Oh, well, that's not Napster. That's for sure.
You know, it's still a good model. I'd take it if we could get it on iTunes. But the original Napster, the one that had the centralized server where all of that information actually resided, was a very easy thing to trace, you know, to whom it went to and where the music was stored illegally. And the recording industry said, oh, no, no, this isn't going to happen. And Lars Ulrich of Metallica said, oh, no, no, this isn't going to happen, and we're going to sue you. And so what ended up happening was all those people who were pirates on Napster said, oh, crap, where are we going to get our music? And they created protocols like the BitTorrent protocol, which made it very, very, very hard to track. So the way this guy did his sample was he used a if anybody knows anything about BitTorrent, is that most torrents are held on what's called a tracker. It's sort of like a hyperlink to the actual file, which could be distributed amongst many, many peers. He took a kind of protocol or subprotocol called mainline DHT, in this case, distributed hash table, which bypasses a normal tracker and goes straight to individual peers, hence peer-to-peer networking. I think there are massive problems with the study, not the least of which is that it is known for a fact that because mainline distributed hash tables ignore what are called private trackers, people who really don't let anyone see the light of day, you know, where you're never going to know what's on them and all that stuff, and you don't have access to them. Because this ignores those flags, all the private trackers disable this kind of ability. So basically, you took 1,021 files that don't represent presumably the vast sum of legit information, and came to the conclusion that 1% of all of these files are infringing. I don't think it's a meaningful number in a number of ways, not the least of which being is that a number of files is sort of an insignificant source of information. A more significant source of information would be like how many megabytes, how many gigabytes, how many terabytes, how many exabytes. And I do want to remind people that even though this article says 99% of these files are infringing, there's 1% that aren't. And that 1% are crucial. Maybe it's World of Warcraft by Blizzard being distributing patches to all of the people who own that program. Maybe it's Linux distros. Maybe it's really sort of important things that some people use every day. And those 1%, even if this number is accurate, are what makes BitTorrent an absolutely both necessary and legal technology. You can go back to the Sony Betamax decision of 86, which essentially said, you know, sure, you can take those Betamax tapes and record television illegally, but you can also make, you know, tapes of your kids playing in the water and all that stuff. Do wedding
videos. I think there are certainly enough legal purposes that you can... oh, there goes my phone. That is excellent.
That's a really creative ringtone.
Oh, yeah, well, that's the Windows Mobile 6.5, which isn't supposed to be running on my Touch Pro. That is the default tone on that.
Okay.
Well, that's kind of nice. Oh, that was Corey Green. You know Corey Green.
I do know Corey Green, our favorite Marine.
Yeah, our favorite Marine friend. Anyways, he probably wants to get a beer or something, but we'll deal with that later.
Indeed.
So,
anyway, I think there are massive problems with the study. For any number of reasons, and I think it is very important to realize that the BitTorrent protocol is actually incredibly useful. It takes the stress off of individual networks by distributing large files, patches to things like World of Warcraft or Linux distros, and putting all of the actual download pressure or upload pressure on a single individual. And the downloader is getting so much information, which, you know, sort of aggregates into this one thing from many networks, that it's very, very efficient and it's not hard on the network.
I use this to download any Linux ISO that I decide to run beside Windows.
Yeah.
You know, there are enough legal things that are on BitTorrent, and it's such a useful technology that, you know, I don't think there's any way to ignore the... those uses of it in lieu of the many illegal things that you could do with it.
Right.
You know?
Even if you admit, and you have to admit, if anybody's seen, you know, one of these torrenting communities, that's a lot of illegal stuff. There's a lot of illegal stuff out there, or illegally obtained stuff. So, it's one thing to admit that there's a tremendous amount of illegally obtained stuff, but it is very important to realize the great value and the benefit of such an efficient protocol.
I think more people should use it. You know, I think people stay away from it because of stories like this headline where it says BitTorrent census about 99% of files copyright infringing.
Right.
You know,
we don't want to be involved in that. And it goes
that scares people away from it.
Right. And it goes to the heart of the problems with, you know, companies like. I'm going to go ahead and say them, Comcast, who are, you know, using traffic throttling and really slowing down people's connections when they detect a certain kind of protocol. It's illegal because they're peering in on that protocol, but we'll not get to that point. It's just unethical because the fact of the matter is, you know, there are people using it for very legitimate purposes. So I think you're right. People should use it more. And would use it more if there wasn't this stigma. I think the survey, and I'm going to call it a survey, or at least a study, but not a census.
And that's a census.
It's the wrong word.
Definitely the wrong word.
Was right in idea. But I think a number of things about it were wrong. I think we need to move on.
Okay, let's do that.
So one of the things that I focus on in the myriad policy issues I look at in the policy world, and that's sort of what I do a little bit of, is the use, going back to the State of the Union. When you pulled up the president doing the State of the Union address on your phone, you were watching it over a product, something called Flash. Macromedia Flash, which is owned by Adobe Systems, which is a terribly inefficient program. But
it is awful.
Absolutely awful. And the amplification of awful in this case being that there's something called locally stored objects or locally shared objects that are necessary for websites to determine how a Flash object is going to render on your screen, essentially. It makes rules. And the thing about Flash is that unlike, say, a cookie in a regular browser, Flash is independent of your browser. So, you know, I have four web browsers right now on my MacBook Pro. I've got Google's Chrome, love it, wish it handled bigger code a little bit more deftly.
I use it on Windows, and it's really
it's the best on Windows.
Phenomenal. And they even have the extension support now, which is really pretty phenomenal.
Well, I'm waiting for that. I use Apple Safari, which is a very robust browser. On occasion, I use Firefox for their extensions, and sometimes Opera. But the thing about Flash is that it's independent of these browsers. So if you have Flash settings, these LSOs as they are, sometimes called Flash cookies, you know, they're going to be storing information or settings or whatever across all of your browsers. So, you know, you could exit one, go into another, but it's still the case that it's there. Anyway, the FTC recently came out of, they had their third round of privacy roundtable talks, which spanned myriad issues on the internet, not the least of which was privacy when it came to advertising and a couple of other things. And they said, you know, people are abusing this Flash ability. Now, Adobe has condemned what's called cookie responding, and I'll explain that in a second. But they are abusing it, and what the FTC said was that we're going to start prosecuting people to do. Now, there are some unethical companies on the internet, most by and large, even the questionably ethical companies don't do this. But it is the case that now people, you know, when you erase your cookies, which is just a normal part of your browser, browsing experience, because presumably you have some sense of privacy, you expect that people aren't tracking you or looking at what you're doing anymore when you go from portal to portal or from website to website. They figured out a way to sort of circumvent that because nobody knows about these LSOs. And some companies have started essentially dropping packets of information into that file, which remember is a cross browser, and tracking you via those. And nobody knows about them or where that folder is. If you're on a Mac, people, you go to Library, Macromedia, Flash Settings. But hey, that's just me. It's something similar on a PC. And they drop these packets of information in, and sometimes they contain unique identifiers. Sometimes even they contain the ability, because they're larger packets of information, to respawn, which is to say, to essentially, you've cleared your cookies, you think you're all good, you're going to go back on the internet feeling clean, you know, you just washed your hair. Well, it turns out you didn't get a giant patch of your hair. In fact, such a large patch that, well, now your hair is all dirty again. Whatever. What they do is these Flash cookies can respawn. And this is not the case by and large, but it is the case for a couple very unethical companies who will likely see prosecution. They can respawn your old HTML cookies when you're not looking, which means companies can collect a little bit more information about you and maybe make a little bit more money or maybe just track you for whatever reason. It's a problem. It's deceptive. It's certainly goes against the notion that you have a certain a certain right to privacy and that you know all of those angles. Anyway, the FTC said they're going to go after people who are doing it.
So they're going to make criminal these companies that are doing that? Or what exactly are they going to do about it?
Well, they're presumably going to file suit. There are only a very few companies Many of them, are in fact, most of them are not, in fact, American companies, I'd say. But there's some companies in, say, Europe and a couple other places that drop these cookies in, and they will respawn cookies on behalf of other people, third-party cookies. The FTC is going to threaten lawsuits, and people are either going to clean up their act or there's going to be, you know, arbitration ending in trial. And it'll be monetary damages. It won't be criminal per se. But they're basically saying this is an unethical behavior, and we're not going to tolerate it. And, you know, they might say differently if it was the case that people knew about these other types of cookie, which, you know.
And if I could just say, hey, be gone with you, and then they would go away, that would be another story entirely.
Exactly right. If you had the option of, when you clear your history and your cookies and your whatever, of also clicking, you know, clearing the LSOs, this would be a totally different matter. But the fact of the matter is that that's not the case with most browsers, or any browser that I know of, and people don't know about it. So it's seen as a deceptive act. Respawning specifically, dropping those in there if there's a privacy policy in place that says, hey, we've got these things, it's for analytic purposes, it's not a big deal, but here you should know about them. If there's a privacy policy in place, there is a certain, and I'm a privacy kind of guy, but there's still a certain legitimacy to them. This is about taking things that went extinct and bringing them back. It's like the Jurassic Park of your cookies. you know, some things just weren't meant to happen.
I'm just imagining right now, not to make light of this, but I'm imagining a cookie with a little cut in its mouth, almost like Pac-Man, and roaring like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. That's the image that has just spawned in my brain. It's trying to eat me. That's the thing. It's frightening. It is
definitely trying to eat you. No, they're scary. You know, LSOs are, and when I say flash cookie, I'm using just the lingo, the sort of the everyday speak of it. It's not an accurate term. A locally shared object actually has most of the time a legitimate use, as I said earlier. And in fact, it's not confined to Flash. Microsoft Silverlight also has this problem. You know, the bottom line of it is that these companies should have figured out a way to make it more secure and let fewer people abuse, this kind of access, but they didn't. And it's the reason that Adobe is coming out and saying, no, we condemn all these companies for abusing the thing that we let lie. And that was the next article that I was going to talk about, is simply that Adobe, feeling the pressure of the FTC, has essentially said, no, we never intended this to happen. And truth be told, they didn't. They just made a terrible program, which hopefully the symptoms of which will be alleviated by HTML5.
I'm very much looking forward to HTML5 and how it's gonna, because you get to embed H.264 MP4 videos. You know, that's YouTube just has their beta HTML5 out right now, mm-hmm. And I was using a MacBook, and usually it sounds like a bloody airplane that's taking off when you view some kind of Flash video, at least in 480 or 720p. And I took a look at a video in HTML5, and the fan actually turned off in the middle of the video.
Exactly. Which, so much less resource intensive. You know, there's a reason Apple doesn't allow you to have Flash on their phone. It's because it's going to burn out the battery in like 10 minutes. I mean, we saw what it did to the battery when you were watching the State of the Union on your phone.
Well, so, that Flash that you saw was actually server-side rendered, so my phone doesn't have to do the work.
Really?
That's kind of interesting. That browser in its entirety is rendered on a server and then sent to me as a compressed video, more or less. It's called Skyfire. You can get it at get.skyfire.com for anybody who might be using Windows Mobile. It's really a pretty nice browser. But it's a lot faster than any other browser, at least on Windows Mobile. It's probably not faster than Safari, mobile Safari.
Getting back to the point, I think that I wanted to make is, you know, These companies, Microsoft, Flash, and I will say this for Microsoft, at least Silverlight has certain aspects of which, you know, are quite productive, specifically being the ability to protect video. For instance, when I watch Netflix streaming on my computer, It's because I can do it with Microsoft Silverlight, and they know that I'm not going to be able to pirate the movie, which is, you know, it's comforting on both ends. But it's not comforting that people are going to be able to track me, and it's not comforting that people are going to be able to abuse these little caveats because the systems weren't well done. And I'm going to go ahead and say Flash in particular, which is extraordinarily resource intensive, and you know, HTML5, as I said, I hope will fix a lot of those things.
I think it will be a very long time before HTML5 can even make a dent in Flash usage. But that said, I endorse it entirely because it is a much better system to have a natively embeddable video than to have some crazy company, Adobe, come in and have this poorly written program that has poor security features that, you know, ends up hurting me, really.
You know, what's so interesting is that Adobe didn't create it in the beginning. You know, Macromedia created it, and then they bought Macromedia.
They bought Macromedia, that's right.
And, you know, so they combined all these wonderful tools, like, you know, the Creative Suite. I mean, Photoshop is a godsend.
Yeah, I use Photoshop.
Illustrator is incredible. Sure. Flash sucks. That's just that is just the case.
That is one of the misses.
Right. So anyway, I could talk for hours about the specific security vulnerabilities and the recent study. If you want to know more about Flash cookies, or in this case, LSOs, there had recently been a study by what is called Superb, a bunch of students over the summer at University of California, Berkeley. They came together and they did a Flash study, and I can give you the name of that now to look up if you wish. And it's called Flash Cookies and Privacy. And if you do that in quotation marks, you should find it. The last thing I think we wanted to talk about was the unfortunate publishing battle that the publisher in this case, what was it? Who was it? It was
Macmillan.
Right. It was one of the six largest publishers. They said to Amazon.com regarding ebooks, you know, in a very similar way to what recording industry and certain companies said to Apple regarding iTunes, we don't like the way you structure your prices. We want more money. You know, you get less money. All the good stuff. And they won. Amazon, in a very angrily worded statement, said, "We don't think you're doing is right. We think $9.99 for an ebook is a good price." In this case, now they're going to get from $14.99 to $16.99, I believe, for a new ebook. But you know, we just can't deal with you with the absence of your books. What was very interesting is that for days, they actually, during this dispute, they stopped selling those books. Physical copies,
electronic copies. That's the big thing.
Amazon.com. When that happens, you've got to be thinking, oh, my bottom line, my bottom line, my bottom line.
Yeah, well, even for Amazon, it's bad for both of them, you know, because Amazon loses 1/6 of its catalog of print and ebook books.
It's full sixth of the catalog, or just it was the sixth of the largest ones?
Oh, it could be. So then it would be less than a sixth.
I mean, it was definitely
a large percentage less.
I think what's really unfortunate about this is that I'm a huge fan of e-reading conceptually. I'm never gonna get over, you know, I mean, I'm an electronics junkie, and I will be the day I die, but I'm never gonna get over the feeling of bending the spine of a paperback book and knowing exactly where I left off, you know? I love the physical copy. But I respect people who are much more ethical than I in using an e-reader. And it's a huge setback. It means that other companies are going to do the same thing to Amazon and to, you know, basically what this company did was they settled on the same price structure that Apple has settled on for their iPad. Anyway, I think that's it.
I think that's about it. That's all we have for you folks today. So, if you thanks for listening to the show. You can follow us on Twitter. We are at the End User. That is T H E N D USR. And I am at Chris Hale Barnes, Dublas, who will be on next week.
Exactly right.
You'll hear from him. He is at Solid Hound, just like you think it's spelled. And Charlie is...
at Brother Metal. That's B-R-O-T-H-E-R-M-E-T-A-L.
And for more information, check out our blog at theendusr.blogspot.com. That is T-H-E-N-D-U-S-R.blogspot.com. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Good night.
Bye, everybody.